You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Now we'll return to that speech by Princeton University professor Cornel West.
But our moment is one in which what? Our media, about as unsocratic as one can imagine for the most part. Mainstream media. Oligopoly at the top. Journalists afraid to raise questions to the powers that be. Thank God for Pacifica and the other voices. Very important. We must support them. It's an indispensable service. Even in our universities, professors running scared. Afraid to speak out. A host of different issues. On the Middle East. Can't even criticize the government's policies without being cast anti-Semitic. You say, wait a minute. Now you got the Israeli left engaging in such powerful critique of their government? If they can do it in Tel Aviv, how come you can't do it in Chicago, New York, and Santa Fe? Anti-Semitism is a vicious bigotry, form of bigotry. There's no doubt about that. But it can also be used to silence critics. We've seen a variety of different languages deployed to try to hide and conceal certain truths that ought to be highlighted. You see. Black folk do it, white folk do it, women do it, Jews do it, Italians do it, Russians do it, across the board. Do we have what it takes to exercise our parhesia? And to exercise phronesis, a practical wisdom rooted in a compassion, you see. And I don't believe it's just a matter of election to election. This past week, Supreme Court spoke 5-4. It was a very significant decision, very important. I didn't applaud, but I was slightly delighted. It was much better than I expected. And the reason I didn't applaud, of course, is because it just struck me still as so narrow that institutions of higher learning could have such long traditions of sons gaining access to these institutions, not always meeting high standards, but no debate. Geographical diversity. People from Idaho and Montana, gang access, not always meeting the highest standards. No debate whatsoever. Athletes gaining access to these slots, not always meeting the highest standards. No debate. Even when they are Ain't Haggard's children, black folk. But after 244 years of slavery, which was against the law for black people to learn how to read and write, Jim Crow, in which they paid, we paid taxes for public institutions of higher learning and couldn't even think of sending our children to those institutions almost a century. And finally getting a foothold and a toehold, and as soon as the black folks show up, you get a national debate about their deficiency and how rigorous the standards ought to be. That's a level of hypocrisy we ought to be honest about. We ought to be candid about that. And if they don't meet minimal qualifications, they don't belong. But how many meet minimal qualification? My God, at Harvard, 9,000 do. They only got 1,800 slots. What are you going to do? Ted Kennedy met minimal qualifications barely and got in and took some Irish working class brother's slot who was brilliant and went to Boston College. I've said this to Brother Kennedy, too, so I'm not speaking behind his back. He knows he got in by legacy, son of, grandson of, brother of. When he showed up, was there a national debate broadcast around the world, every corner of the globe, about the deficiency of Irish rich folk? No. When George Bush showed up at Yale, was there a debate about rich WASPs? No. But no, let Jamal show up. Let Letitia show up. And the whole machinery kicks in. And all of a sudden, now everybody's so concerned about everybody having 780 on the board score above, or if not, we're going to sue you. And we should keep in mind that the three brothers, the three white fellow citizens who sued, they could have chosen white students who had board scores much lower too. They didn't. They chose the Negroes. What's going on? Hypocrisy. Let's be honest about it. So I was slightly delighted. You see, but some folk had a party, and I stayed home and listened to Luther Vandross. God bless him. He just left the hospital. He's in rehabilitation center. Thank God Almighty. To bring this to a conclusion here now, how is my clock doing? Yeah, I got good time. That's good. I've got very good time. But what we have is an American empire with three basic pillars. The free market fundamentalism. And all forms of fundamentalism for those who was engaged in Socratic activity, worthy of deep suspicion. All forms of fundamentalism reduce complexity, create Manichaean views of the world, all good on one side, all evil on the other. And the free market fundamentalism says what? The market is a fetish. It has magical powers. If you have a social problem, marketize, privatize, commodify, commercialize, and somehow, some way, things will be all right. Markets are legal constructions created by human beings to be used for good or for ill. There are sick markets like health care. There are highly competitive markets like supermarkets. Free market fundamentalism says what? Privatize even those mechanisms that have to do with satisfying people's most basic needs, like the Bush administration's attempt to privatize Social Security. And that's just one instance among others. So that what happens? Common good, public interest wanes. And the market, that legal construction that requires some non-market values to operate, begins to run amok, becomes more and more unedited, unregulated. And Adam Smith understood so very well. It's no accident he wrote not only The Wealth of Nations, but also A Theory of Moral Sentiments. Both books are very important in understanding the early theorists of the market, because he knew that a contract was predicated on non-contractarian values like trust and loyalty. And when we look at free market fundamentalism run amok, we see Enron, we see World.com, we see corporate elites acting as gangsters. And I use the word gangster because, of course, there's been a lot of debate about gangster rappers. And we use that term about them so easily. They ought to be shaming themselves, those gangster rappers talking about all that raw stuff. You say, no, they're just mirroring what they see in the larger society. They look in corporate America and see gangster activity. Gangster activity can be characterized as those preoccupied with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Gang access to power, pleasure, property by any means. And of course, in the case of corporate elites, billions and billions and billions of dollars confiscated, embezzled, stolen. And contrast that with the thousands of dollars that welfare mothers stole and embezzled. They get put on the front page and stay there. Corporate elites get a little hit on the wrist. We've got a Corporate Responsibility Act that we were very upset about. We're going to please. Free market fundamentalism will undermine the very conditions for the possibility of democracy, because democracy is predicated on a vital public life. And you end up with a younger generation that believes, in fact, that the market way of life is the human way of life. To be human is to be stimulated, titillated, rather than nourished, rather than deeply empowered. Believe that buying and selling and promoting and advertising are the fundamental ways of being in the world. Learn how to package yourself. Go to school, high school, and college, not in order to engage in paideia and cultivation of self and soul, but to acquire a skill so you can gain access to some dynamite job and live in some vanilla suburb. What an impoverished way of being in the world. Eugene O'Neill said it so well in Iceman Cometh, or at least in his interview prior to The Iceman Cometh in 1946, he said, Americans suffer from this notion that somehow they can possess their souls by means of possessing commodities. Don't they recognize that they'll end up a nation and an empire who has the capacity to conquer the world but has completely lost its soul? Oh, Eugene, we need you, brother. Your insight still ripples down through these 57 years since the Ice Man cometh with the pipe dreams of Hickey and his partners in Harry Hope's saloon, dangling the empty carrots of an empire that on the outside is so powerful, but on the inside is so hollow and shallow when it comes to its spirit and soul. It's no accident Martin Luther King Jr. entitled the theme of the freedom movement, the slogan of the Southern Leadership Christian Conference, what? Saving the soul of America. He didn't have to read Eugene O'Neill's Iceman Cometh to know what he was talking about. And of course, Malcolm X suggested, Brother Martin, America has no soul, brother. You're missing the point. It's about power. And Martin said, I'm not naive, Malcolm. I know it's very much about power, but a democracy must also be about common good and public life, and I'm a Democrat, small d. And if you play only the game of power, then Thrasymachus is right in Plato's Republic. Might makes right. And I refuse to simply play the game of power, even though I'll bring power to bear with a moral vision. And of course, as Malcolm continued to grow, he said, you know, Martin, I begin to see your point more clearly now. You're absolutely right. Even your language of love makes sense to me. Because it is, in fact, better to fight to save the soul rather than to blind oneself and live a soulless life in an imperial country. It's a certain way of being in the world. A certain bearing witness, even if you are unable to bring about the kind of changes you want in your generation, somebody will know 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, you bore witness, you tried to speak the truth and expose lies so that you can then bequeath that legacy to them. Tradition is not something you inherit, T.S. Eliot says. You have to fight for it in order to actually gain access to your tradition. You can't keep a tradition of struggle for freedom and democracy alive without people willing to bear witness, even in a bleak moment when they know that they will never see the positive results in their lifetime. That's part of our challenge today. That's part of our challenge, this historical moment. That's one reason why we live in the age of Chekhov. Oh, Anton Chekhov, grandson of a slave, medical doctor, administers to the poor during the day and writes short stories and plays at night. And his age was one of what? Deep disillusionment, deep disappointment, deep disenchantment, and yet what? Endurance through suffering, struggle through darkness. Why? Because it's not about just winning. It's about testifying and bearing witness. You get this even in our dominant forms of religiosity in the United States, right? Especially Christianity. American Christianity is a market form of Christianity for the most part. It's all about identifying with a winner. That's why Easter Sunday the churches are full, but Good Friday they're empty. I'll show up when the winner pops up. But don't tell me about the main protagonist being treated like a political prisoner by the Roman Empire. Don't tell me about a senseless death based on injustice. And certainly don't tell me about the Saturday in which, echoing Nietzsche, God is dead, even for Christians. We don't get too much theothanatology in Christian thought these days. But God is dead that Saturday. And there was no thought of a bounce back. That's why Peter himself said, I didn't know the brother three times. Never seen him. No recollection of him. Then that's Peter. That's the foundation of the church, right? But to live in the age of Chekhov says what? Yes, we can look at that darkness. We can look at the Patriotic Act 1, the Patriotic Act 2, the escalating authoritarianism, the violation of rights and liberties of Arab brothers and sisters and Muslim brothers and sisters. And if they start there, an Arab American is just as American as any other American in this nation. They start there, it easily creeps. It's easily extended. We can look at the aggressive militarism. Iraq today, Syria, Iran, North Korea tomorrow. Very dark. Chekhov says what? Keep smiling. Keep fighting. Keep thinking. Keep loving. Keep serving. Keep sacrificing. It's not about the win overnight. It's not about the quick fix. It's not about the push button solution. It's about what kind of human being you want to be. What kind of legacy you want to live. Reminds one very much of the blues. Been down so long that down don't worry me no more. That's why I keep keeping on anyway. It's not logical. It's not logical at all. Because if you depend solely on the logic, you're in deep trouble. And that's another reason why I think that a blues people have so much to teach a blues nation. That the doings and sufferings and visions of black people in the Chekhovian manner have much to teach the United States now that as a nation we have the blues. Not just in our economy. Workers have had it for a long time. Not just in our homes. Sisters of all colors dealing with domestic violence. Not just in our social life. Gay brothers and lesbian sisters devalued, dealing with the hypocrisy of the straits, the insecurity of the straits. No, now it's a national community. We can all go to friends and receive a common response, right? No matter what color you are, oh my God, I'm more American than I thought. I didn't feel that American in Chicago, but I'm very American in Paris. What's going on here? Yes. Part of a community that is perceived by the world as being arrogant, disrespectful of international law, unwilling to cooperate with other nations, imposing our will on the world. And I don't believe that's going to change. I don't believe that's going to change. And of course, we haven't even begun to talk about Africa and the AIDS epidemic and what role Africa and Latin America can play in possible shapings of a better world in light of their struggles at this particular moment. Latin America has a long history of American imperial treatment. Long history of it, you see. They have much to teach us. But the blues people in the midst of the American empire, largely but not exclusively peoples of color, have much to teach if they are willing to step forward. The danger here, of course, is what? There's a lot of cowardice in the black community. Afraid to speak. Want to get it on the goodies. Grab the booty of the empire. We're seeing it more and more and more. Black politicians won't mention one word about the prison industrial complex. We have a whole presidential campaign, an election. There's no talk about the connection between the criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex because they've all agreed to be hard on crime. And hard on crime means war of drugs against poor young people, disproportionately black and brown. And this goes for those black folk in the Democratic Party. I was just with Brother Jesse 2 days ago at the Rainbow Coalition. I said, Brother Jesse, it's good to see you stepping out, brother. He's getting upset. He was just at Benton Harbor, Michigan. You all know what happened there. Another instance, peak of an iceberg, part of the 112 yearly young black people who are shot down like dogs by police who happen to pull the trigger when their backs are turned. And we think, oh, my God, Rodney King, glad we hadn't heard about that again. It's happening all the time. Cincinnati, Benton Harbor, Los Angeles, New York, over and over again. A lot of black leaders don't want to talk about it. People ask me, oh, Brother West, why are you hanging around with Al Sharpton? Al Sharpton needs to get a haircut. I'm concerned about his brain. What's he thinking? His heart, his soul. Got a flawed history? Absolutely. Absolutely. Has he changed? Is he speaking any truths that make sense vis-a-vis other candidates in Democratic primary? I'm just raising questions. I'm not proselytizing him. Just raising questions, you see. But who's going to talk about a criminal justice complex? 2 million fellow Americans in jail, 50% black, 46% of young black men between 16 and 25 in Baltimore, Chicago, part of the criminal industrial complex. What does it take in the black community? How many of your children need to be in prison before you get indignant? Unless you think somehow they're genetically inclined, we still got fellow Americans who think that. There'll always been some of those folk around. White supremacy dies very slowly, even on the pseudoscientific front. What happens when it begins to escalate? The fastest group going into prison right now is poor white brothers. I'm just as concerned about them as I am poor black. They're human beings like anybody else. Where's the focus? Or do we have to wait until the criminal justice system begins to expand over Princeton and University of Chicago, Stanford. Oh, you know, we think we got a crisis with our young people at this point. I think we really need to do something serious. Michael Moore showed that so well in his film, Caliban. Black kids, brown kids been shooting each other down for decades. You get one major shootout in white America, everybody stops. Got to be very sensitive here. You know, these are very complex situations. This is... Got to be nuanced here. These are nice kids. They're like us. They're all American, you know. Oh, I see. Very different approach here, huh? What a situation. What are we to do? In on the blue note. No optimism here. The evidence does not look good. Be a freedom fighter in the 21st century is to make a radical distinction between hope and optimism. One must be a prisoner of hope. Yes. unconditional commitment to mustering the courage to think critically, speak freely. Unconditional commitment to a courage to try to keep track of the humanity of each and every person, the courage to love, serve, and sacrifice. And an unconditional commitment to fight for democracy in its substantive form, a rich public life, a pervasive common good with the private sector and its precious rights and liberties protected, yes, but balanced in such a way that it does not suffocate the public forms of expression or community, of what holds us together, what connects us, so that our glue does not become so weak that we end up so polarized that we're at each other's throats, in part because we're not organized and mobilized against those powers that be at the top. How rare it is in American history when significant enough numbers of the citizenry can organize and look upward, confront the powers that be, rather than scapegoat the most vulnerable. That's the easiest thing, you see. And in the end, we're talking about leadership that has a blue note and a blue sensibility, but it's also a leadership that, by example, in being willing to speak, act, write, fuse, share, laugh, love with others, that it can inspire others, so it becomes contagious. There's never any guarantee of any victory in history. Never, never been, never will be. But if we can convince each other to become less conformist and less complacent, more Socratic, more prophetic, more radically democratic, we have a chance. And I hope and pray that each one of you, in wrestling with these questions, try to take seriously the Socratic and prophetic and democratic challenge that I've put forward tonight. We've given up our sweat. We've given up our tears. All the world.
Be Paid by Prince. Cornel West, professor of theology and African American studies at Princeton University, speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico at an event sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. Special thanks to Thunder Road Productions for that recording. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening, and have a safe and happy Labor Day weekend. I wanna know. We'll be right back.